Do you like comics? We're here to talk comics. This is the Superhuman Registration Podcast.
So, the question remains, what kind of threat would John Cena face that only Aldo could protect him from it? He has physical capabilities above those of the natural mortal men. He also has extremely good camouflage, from what I've heard. So, Aldo, how can you protect one of our nation's resources? He's not secretly Canadian, is he?
I think if anything, I could probably serve as very good bait.
There you go.
I could bait out his enemies.
Over there, Mr. Cena, what kind of grenade are you jumping on that you could protect John Cena?
The hater grenade.
I just got this image of Aldo like jumping on the grenade and like Steve Rogers in that scene in Captain America. You know, Tommy Lee Jones, but it's John Cena's face superimposed, just like staring down at him, shocked and maybe a little bit enamored.
It's not a grenade. It's a waifu pillow from some anime that nobody knows about. Aldo's like, you don't want none of this. This is too deep down the anime hole. I'll take it.
I was going to say the threat that could potentially endanger John Cena that Aldo could save him from, potentially a bar quiz to the death over My Hero Academia.
Yeah, probably. I will say for somebody who I deeply respect, I don't know if that man actually watches or cares about anime. And I feel like he's a wrestler. I don't want to know.
I feel like he might.
Like he all might?
Yeah.
He's a wrestler, but he's not a black wrestler.
Oh my gosh.
No, like, okay, here's the thing. One of my favorite YouTubers is FD Signifier. Who, again, I made this comment off, before we started recording, but I love me a good leftist YouTuber making a video about professional wrestling.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think I've actually watched all of these, but, you know, FD Signifier makes a lot of videos about black culture, about white supremacy and all of this stuff. And he talks a lot about, like, black people as prominent figures in competitive fighting games. He talks about, you know, black people kind of glomming onto professional wrestling and some of these other things. And it's just interesting to me is all. I don't understand it. There's a black person who lives across the street from me, and that's kind of it as far as my in-person involvement with... Utah doesn't have that many black people in it.
It does not. You're correct.
I want to just be clear. This person's videos about talking about white supremacy is against that.
Oh, yeah. Right? No, dude. FD Signifier is black.
Uh-huh.
He is, I actually don't know what his profession is. He's been a teacher, I think. He's worked with a lot of, like, kids in schools. He talks a lot about masculinity, which is one of the things that I like about him. Because a lot of YouTubers talk about masculinity from kind of, like, gay perspective or from a feminist perspective. And he does that. Like, he's really good at trying to be intersectional. But he is himself a happily married straight man. And so he's like, no, we need positive role models, positive models of masculinity. And he talks about not necessarily, you know, patriarchal, but if you are a straight man, you can be a good that. And he also tears down, you know, bigots and racists and all sorts of other, like, unpleasantness. He's an interesting watch. And I love it, like, every leftist YouTuber, whenever they do cultural, like, pop cultural commentary, I love that stuff. He just did a video on The New Day. And black men in professional wrestling. Mostly black men. I think they're black women are more prominent now. And according to him, they're actually kind of like the headliners a little bit. I don't follow professional wrestling enough to know if any of this stuff is true. I just love it when they talk about wrestling because I'm never going to watch wrestling. But wrestling sounds interesting when other people talk about it.
FD Signifier is very good, especially as somebody who's like interested in those... cultures that I am not a part of. He does a very good job at kind of informing you kind of like where he comes from, like where that point of view kind of comes from in relation specifically to his like background as opposed to just the general, you know, male background and stuff like that. It's interesting.
But yeah, New Day seemed pretty cool, I guess.
Yeah, they also showed up to a WrestleMania event in Super Saiyan armor.
Yes, I've seen the pictures of that.
So, you know, they're all right. I like them.
Should we start actually talking about the comics that we read?
I was really hoping we could talk more about anime and how it connects to every facet of life and how...
Don't even get me started.
About anime at all. We have barely talked about anime at all.
Any amount of it, I know so little. I know so little about anime. So any amount of it is just like, well, I'm out of my depth here. Go on, guys.
There's like a very special, like, sweet spot talking about, like, anime culture. Like, it's when you break past casual, but before you get into, like, weeb otaku, there's, like, a beautiful little sweet zone there that's super interesting to talk about, like, anime culture. And not, it's so hard to find people who talk about that little area of it. Anyways.
It's not us.
Not at all, no.
It's not us. Anyway, we're not here to talk about anime anymore until we inevitably reference it later on tonight. This is the Superhuman Registration Podcast. We are nominally here to talk about Marvel comics that we have been reading, and we will compile a big list of all of the comics that we've read and rank them in terms of quality. Tonight, we have read Mockingbird solo series from, I already forgot the year, 2016, 2017? And then we also read Hulk Gray, 2016, ha, got it, 2016 for Mockingbird. And then we also read Hulk Gray by Jeff Loeb and Tim Sale, and we are excited to talk about these books. And we, of course, is myself, and then Aldo and John. Evening, fellas.
Hello.
John sad.
Is John sad because we read Hulk Gray and it's kind of a bummer?
Yeah.
I will say, for picking out two books seemingly like out of random, I feel like thematically they were super similar.
I'm going to be really curious to hear where you're getting that connection in.
I mean, super, super broad strokes before we even get into any of the details. Both of these are books about individuals who have been given, who have been dealt a sort of toxic radiation-laced sort of hand in life. And on top of dealing with that, they're also dealing with their own personal, like, mental issues about who they are and why people should or shouldn't love them that they try to bring into their lives. In that sense, both of these books, to me, were very thematically resonant.
Oh, interesting. Well, while we're talking about these books, where do we want to start?
Probably Hulk.
You want to start with Hulk? Okay.
I think it'd be a little less of a bummer to end on... Mockingbird.
You know, fair enough.
So the partnership of Jeff Loeb and Tim Sale has seen many different titles, a lot of Batman. Looking over at my shelf, let's see. Batman the Long Halloween, Haunted Night, Dark Victory, and on Superman for All Seasons. Sorry, there's a Superman stack in the middle of my shelf.
So good.
Batman's on the other side. But anyway, for Marvel, they have Spider-Man Blue. They have Daredevil Yellow. This one was next, Hulk Gray in 2003, and later on, Captain America Black and White. Or might have just been Captain America White. That seemed really troubling.
It was Captain America White.
Hoo boy. But we're not talking about that. We're talking about Hulk Gray from 2003. 6 issues, written by Jeff Loeb and drawn by Tim Sale, with Matt Hollingsworth doing the colors and Richard Starkings as the letterer. The covers also are all done by Tim Sale, and they're all fabulous. I asked a art teacher how I can, you know, get better at drawing, and he said, okay, well, pick out some comics you like and kind of go from there. And I picked out some Jim Lee Batman, and then I picked out a Long Halloween, trying to get, you know, different styles. And apart from, like, you know, very neatly drawn and anatomically correct, you know, we get the really cool, I don't care, guys, I know that I'm like the fan here, but this is some of my favorite of this partnership, is seeing Tim Sale's Hulk. It's very much like in the spirit of the original Jack Kirby style, where it's almost, you know, Frankenstein kind of shapes, you know, and hair and everything. His original color in the comics was gray, and this is kind of building off of that. And the story is basically the first week or so of the Hulk being the Hulk. In the first issue, the Hulk appears. He fights some army guys. They start chasing him. He goes to Betty. The army confronts him at, this is Betty Ross, you know, and the army confronts him. The general orders them to take out the Hulk, but they, you know, Hulk is worried that Betty's going to get hurt, so he takes off. Rick Jones catches up to him in the desert. Banner tells him to put him in a, like, nuclear storage place with a, you know, secure door that he can't get out of. He wants to, like, trap the Hulk and see if he can figure it out. I realized I forgot the framing device. I'll come back to it. Thunderbolt Ross interrogates Rick. Hulk escapes from this, and then they bring in Iron Man to try to fight the Hulk. They have a fight in issue 4. Hulk ends up winning. Betty stops him from going too far, and then the fifth issue is just Hulk trying to take care of and failing at taking care of Betty out in the wilderness. And then the last issue, Banner is kind of dealing with, am I a monster? Is Hulk any better or worse than the general who's, you know, doesn't care at all about his daughter and is just, you know, singularly driven and uncompromising? You know, where is the gray and this kind of black and white of good and evil and everything? The whole story is framed in a conversation between Bruce Banner and his friend Doc Samson, sometimes enemy, fellow Hulk cast member, I guess, along with Rick Jones. They frequently appear in Hulk comics, but he's a psychiatrist and he's trying to help Bruce, who's come to him, trying to sort out his past. And he tells him kind of this early Hulk story. They've kind of snuck in the origin there. Again, I picked this one because I really love the art. I like the books that these guys come out with, whatever the publishing company. But what did you all think?
As far as the art goes, which I've always been a little lukewarm on it, I see why people love it. Like, I'm not going to say it's bad. This is the one where I think it shines. I think this is the book where that art style really helps convey a lot.
Yeah, Hulk is just monstrous. He's not like... Even Kirby, like, drew the Hulk, I feel like, with, you know, kind of heroic proportions. They're definitely different. He draws the Hulk different from Captain America, for example. But here, Sale draws the Hulk like a monster. He's just big. He's squat. He has no neck. Just his shoulders lead straight into his head. He's very square. His teeth are jagged and like pointing it all over the place. Very, very good monstrous design of the Hulk. But it does, like, it doesn't go so far towards monstrous that the character becomes unappealing, right?
Mm-hmm. It's a fine line.
Yeah. Well, I think it works when they need him to look like a monster, because there are certain parts in here, specifically when he's talking to Betty, where he definitely starts leaning a little bit more human.
His expression, yeah, softens.
Yeah, well, like, his expression, the way he's drawn, the close-ups are not nearly as dramatic. Like, at one point, there's a close-up when he's, like, yelling. He's mad. I think he's yelling at Rick. And it's just his face. Like, there's no other details of his head. So it just kind of makes him look even bigger than he normally is by just, like, that close-up. But then when he's talking to Betty, we get a lot of him, like, standing up. Like looking more like just kind of a big person. Mm-hmm. When he's having those interactions with her specifically.
Or he's crouched down trying to be at her level and trying to, you know, cradle her.
Yeah.
But she's so scared of him, he realizes he has to keep his distance. I like how he is crammed into most of these panels. His first appearance, his whole right arm is all but cut off. You only get his fist. You know, the angle is way down low. He's in shadow. He's the strongest there is. It's just, you know, really terrifying. He's just staring down Rick Jones. He's like, well, dude, what are you? And then every other panel, it's just these really strong, you know, poses, these silhouettes of just raw power, you know. And he has that kind of like I said before, like Frankensteinian kind of head shape and everything in the hair, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, Betty is drawn like, you know, every pretty Hollywood star that you've ever, like, it's the saddest, prettiest, you know, classic Hollywood star that you've ever seen, you know, just gorgeous. And like Thunderbolt Ross is just angry and just, you know, he's like furious this whole time. And most of his, you know, panels are the same, like right up close in his face, just showing all of that emotion. I really like it.
Mm-hmm. Plot's not very good.
No, it's kind of like, I couldn't get a good sense of really what Banner was trying to figure out, because he comes to Doc Samson, I think it's after Betty has died in the comics, and since, of course, you know,
that's
she's
what
come
it seems
back.
Like, yeah.
Yeah, she's Red She-Hulk now, but it seems like he's trying to, you know, sort out his past and his feelings and if he was ever good for her or whatever. It wasn't clear to me, and it, you know, it could have just been like, there are a lot of different ways that it could have been posed, but it was just kind of like a meandering conversation, I think, that, you know, kind of played against whatever the action was going on.
Yeah, yeah. I felt like too much of the story was really spread out to fill 6 issues. I think this easily could have been a 3-issue comic.
Yeah,
but
we'd get that much less art. But yeah,
you know, yeah, that is actually a very good point, because this is, the art is really good. I didn't appreciate Tim Sale very much when I read him younger, as I've been reading more comics, especially since he passed. I've come to appreciate his style a lot more, and how it's a choice, and it's not always an appealing choice, but it's always a memorable one. I haven't read the Batman trilogy he did with Jeff Loeb in easily over a decade now, but I still remember some of those images. They're very good.
Yeah.
But yeah, as far as like the plot, I think part of the reason you could condense it so much is that there's not that much to this story. To me, and if either of you got more than this, I'm really interested to hear it, but to me, it just seems like the thing that Banner is struggling with, the reason that he calls Doc Samson up in the middle of the night, is to vent over how he sees a lot of Thunderbolt Ross in himself. He's like so similar to this man that he hates that, you know, ultimately, like, that I guess calls into question his relationship with Betty. Like, was I any better to her than her father was? She loved him even though he was a monster, and she loved me, but I'm a monster. It's just more self-loathing repackaged with daddy issues. But it's almost like daddy issues by proxy, because it's almost about Betty's daddy issues. But obviously it's not, because she's not there. She's not the one talking to the psychiatrist. It's the Hulk who's talking to the psychiatrist. It's Banner. And so it doesn't matter, it feels like. Because the Hulk is a character that I struggle with. Like, how do you make this character compelling? We've read good Hulk stories. We've read a lot of them now. But I feel like I've read more stories like this one than I have good Hulk stories. And it seems to me that embracing the anger is a good start to making a good Hulk story. When it starts to get into the self-loathing, I can see why a creator might want to do that. I can see why it would be compelling, potentially. It rarely works for me, I think, because you're reading about the Hulk. You want to see the Hulk be the Hulk, whether that's heroic, whether that's monstrous, whatever. The self-loathing is not something that I think we want to read in anyone, frankly. I don't know many characters who, like, self-loathing is such a defining aspect of their persona that if that's the only thing we're reading of them, we're satisfied.
Daredevil, maybe?
That's probably, yeah.
Daredevil's actually a really good counter-argument.
Here's the thing I will say. Kind of in agreement with you, is that a lot of heroes, it is really, the process of getting from point A to point B is really interesting, to the point where when they finally get to, you know, point B, that's a really good payoff. I feel that a lot of books struggle with that, where with the Hulk, I feel like the more interesting things are when you start at point B and the whole thing is staying in there, or, you know, vice versa, right? You start as point A and it's resisting moving over there. I think those are the stories that make the Hulk stories interesting. And in this metaphor, point A is Banner and point B is the Hulk. That process, whatever it is, if it's like mental or whatever, it's not nearly as interesting. And I think that's part of the problem here is we spent so much time in that in between. And it's not necessarily clear, right? Like you were saying, his visit with his psychiatrist, is the purpose of it seems a little unclear. Like he's maybe there to talk about, you know, that comparison of himself to Thunderbolt Ross and his relationship with Betty. It also seems like he's struggling to separate himself from the Hulk, where he's not talking about himself, you know, themselves as separate entities. He's talking about both of them as just him, which doesn't let him forgive or excuse the Hulk, because he himself is not allowed to be excused or, you know, dismissed in any of his actions. There's a moment where the Hulk hurts Betty and it's an accident, like completely an accident, right? I don't think the Hulk is necessarily at fault there. He's in the middle of fighting a gold robot / Iron Man, and she gets in the middle of that kerfuffle and, you know, hits her. And he does not allow any leeway on that when the psychiatrist kind of brings up that it's an accident. And so, so that's also like another story where he's talking about, you know, the lack of forgiveness on the Hulk, but really it's a lack of forgiveness on himself. There's like a few things going on there. And I think the fact that that's unclear, like why he's there specifically, doesn't really help the narrative all that much. So we get a lot of this him in there. It's kind of unclear which way he wants to head. Does he want to be and accept and be the Hulk? Or does he want to reject the Hulk and be Bruce Banner, right? Like that's kind of where the muddiness comes for me.
Yeah. And well, I think that muddiness is there because there isn't that level of intent at the creative level. Like this isn't I don't think that this is a case of Jeff Loeb had a clear vision of the theme he wanted to explore and it just didn't get there in the delivery. I don't think that this was very clearly developed beyond Hulk and Ross are the same. And maybe if you're more invested in the lore of the Hulk, that is compelling. I don't think that Thunderbolt Ross is the Hulk's best villain.
Okay, but is Thunderbolt Ross Banner's best villain?
No, the Hulk is Banner's best villain. Took no time to answer that.
I see that, yeah. That's very clear.
Are all of these Loeb Sale Marvel books about dead girlfriends?
I was just going to say that is, you know, Peter Parker is recording a message to Gwen Stacy, his funny Valentine, that's that. Daredevil, he's, you know, talking about Karen Page in the past tense as well. I mean, Catwoman When in Rome is just what Catwoman was doing in the chapter she was missing from Long Halloween, if that helps.
Ah, yes, the famous Marvel book, Catwoman When in Rome.
Look, well, you can't have a dead girlfriend if the girlfriend's the protagonist.
Yeah, see?
Well, I mean, you can.
Yeah, it is kind of a repeat of framing, you know. I don't know, part of me wonders if, like, there was a clear question that he was like dancing around that Doc Samson hits him with towards the end, and then we kind of see how it resolves out and it makes some better sense and helps him move on from either Betty dying or from this struggle of am I a monster, am I a hero, am I better or worse or the same as her father, that kind of thing. Like there could have been a punchier way to frame it in that conversation that he's having. I wish that he had like another, like, I don't know if this is this kind of conversation is similar to a specific movie, but there's a lot lifted in Long Halloween from The Godfather, and I think it actually helps.
Mm-hmm. I would agree with that, actually.
And like it's done in a way that it's an homage, and it's you know, it's not stealing the way that he does it. It's like, you know that this is Godfather. I know this is Godfather, and aren't we in on this cool thing that, you know, this is what we're doing here? It's almost like this needed that. Like let's tell a Hulk story through the lens of blank. You know, what if it was, you know? Well, now I want to see a Hulk Sunset Boulevard movie. That'd be wild.
Now I want to see Hulk Mulholland Drive.
Oh, there you go.
Now I want to see Hulk Muppets.
But see, he would have to be a Muppet, though.
Am I a man? Or am I a monster?
Am I a monster?
If I'm a man, I'm a monster of a man.
A monster of a man.
The fact that we live in the year of our Lord 2024 and we do not have an official Muppets Marvel special makes me sad. What good is all of this monopolizing Disney if you don't do anything cool with it?
Here's the thing. Sorry, quick Muppets tangent. Disney doesn't know what to do with the Muppets.
No.
They had one good movie, and then they completely lost it. The second Muppets movie under the Disney umbrella, like the
Muppets Most Wanted.
That movie's actually good, but nobody saw it. And I blame the marketing.
Yeah, it was okay. It had a lot of famous people in it. There's some genuinely funny stuff in it, but not quite like... It didn't hit the same way that the other one did. I think...
Do you know what else doesn't hit the same way as the first Muppets movie? Every Muppets movie.
I think Muppets Treasure Island is fine.
Muppets Treasure Island is fine. So it's like you have eras, you have distinct eras of Muppets. The first era of Muppet cinema, Muppet movies, you've got the Muppet movie, the Muppets Take Manhattan, and the Great Muppet Caper. The Muppet movie is the good one.
Yeah.
And then you get the adaptation era that starts with Muppet Christmas Carol, and you've got Muppet Treasure Island. Weirdly, Muppets in Space is kind of wedged in there as well. Christmas Carol is the good one. That's not to say there isn't good stuff in the other things. Muppet Treasure Island is actually about as good as I remember it from when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And then in the Disney era, The Muppets was really good, and they never Jason quite Siegel. Hit that high again.
I think it's because of Jason Segel. He was passionate about it. They made the songs for it. It was tonally... Except for the fart shoes thing. Tonally, the rest of it was like, yeah, this is Muppets. This is fun.
Yeah.
My sidebar on this was going to be, what movie that exists that is not a Muppet project would you turn into a Muppet project? And I see this question online. Like, who's the one human and who are the Muppets in a Muppet version of a famous movie?
So, the question is bad.
Okay, fix the question.
Here's the problem with the question. The best Muppet adaptations do not follow that formula. Muppet Christmas Carol didn't like plug all of the famous Muppets into the main character roles. Yes, they had Michael Caine as basically the only human. There were other humans, but he's the only one that matters. And yes, Kermit the Frog played Cratchit and Gonzo played Shakespeare, or whatever his name is.
Dickens.
I'm very Dickens. Tired, guys.
You're an English major.
Your mom's an English major. Anyway, but when it comes to like the emotional core of the movie, which are the scenes between Scrooge and the ghosts, they didn't cast Animal as the ghost of Christmas Future, which was apparently one of the ideas they had when they were scripting this.
Death! 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 Instead of drugs.
And that's the thing, is like, for Muppet Christmas Carol, they created the Muppets specifically to be the ghosts of Christmas past, present, and future. They didn't get existing Muppets to play those roles because they needed a stronger emotion than you would get if you had Kermit's nephew Robin reciting the lines of the Ghost of Christmas Past. And so, just, you know, creating Pride and Prejudice and casting Miss Piggy as Lizzie Bennet, you know, misses the point to some extent. And that's also part of the reason that I think that Muppet Treasure Island isn't quite as good, because it missed that message.
So to answer your question, John, Top Gun.
See, Aldo took it. Thank you, Aldo.
And I would absolutely have Tom Cruise playing himself, because you know he would love to be around the Muppets.
Oh, yeah.
He basically is one already.
Guys, I know you're going to say that like Goose should be Fozzie, but no, Goose, they should have a new character that's a goose. It can still be Anthony, what's his name, doing the voice and everything like that, but it's definitely a goose Muppet. And also, dang it, I was going to say something else funny.
I think it should be Grover. I think Grover would be an excellent goose.
Near?
But Grover's far. Sesame Street.
Crash!
Oh, you're right.
He's still a
Disney
Muppet.
Disney doesn't own Sesame Street.
Oh, that's HBO, well, you're right.
It could be like a Who Framed Roger Rabbit, where we make a deal that everyone just says, hey, we're just going to do this. Everyone's going to be cool with it. And we're going to have a scene where Mickey is parachuting next to Bugs Bunny. And it's all of your childhood dreams without like selling it back to you like they're trying to do with all their intellectual property right now.
I'm just saying one of the two, either Maverick or Goose, one of the two needs to be a Muppet, mostly because I do want to see a Muppet behind enemy lance in not Russia, China stand-in.
Guess what? That's Muppet's Most Wanted.
Yeah.
Oh, excellent. There you go.
Tina Fey plays a Russian lady.
Tina Fey plays a Russian lady, but she's like, it's a Siberian gulag. Like, there's no, like, none of this nonsense in Maverick where it's like, oh, the enemy, and it's like, we're keeping it vague and keeping it snowy so you know it's North Korea or Russia, but we're not going to tell you which one it is, but it's those dang commies. I hate Top Gun Maverick so much. I hate it, hate it, hate it. The correct answer is Les Mis, and Hugh Jackman's the only human.
Except Hugh Jackman was not very good in Les Mis. That's my other hot take.
Oh, shut up. Are you this guy?
I don't think that's a hot take, is it?
Yes, I am that guy. It's not his fault.
Yeah, I was going to say, I thought that wasn't a hot take.
It depends on who you ask, I guess. We do not have time for another sidebar. We are now, like, several tangents away from the Hulk. Do we have anything more to say about the Hulk story?
Very good art, not very good narrative. Not bad, not a terrible narrative, but not great. Yeah, not set by the expectations of this team. Like, it does not match those expectations that are set by this creative team.
It'd be tough to say which one on the Marvel side I like more between Daredevil Yellow and Spider-Man Blue. Daredevil Yellow, I think, is an original story, and Spider-Man Blue is almost like a retelling. Like, some of the panels from John Romita Sr., I think, are just redrawn, because it's like, hey, we're doing this era, so we're going to draw these 60s characters in a 60s style and like try to homage that again, you know. I don't know, they're both so good, but this one, the Hulk, is just really cool looking, and that's another one. Steve and I agree, like, it's, you know, a good Hulk story is hard to find. When you get one, though, it's extra good, like, you know, World War Hulk or Planet Hulk, both of those we've read.
Yeah. I think part of the reason why those are good is because they are in kind of like that analogy I was saying, right? From point A to point B.
Mm-hmm.
You're in point B. You're trying to stay there. That's a lot of the stories. You don't want to go back to Banner. You don't want to do anything that will set you back to Banner. Like, I've also heard that a couple of the Banner stories where he is completely split from the Hulk are also really good because it's him trying to keep the Hulk away or out of him. I've heard.
I liked Stay Angry that we read, where Banner's a bad guy and he's wheeling and dealing with terrorists all over the place, and he gets himself into situations that only the Hulk can get him out of, and like sets it up so that he calms the Hulk down somehow so he can get control again. But they're both like wrestling over the steering wheel, and it's interesting. It is goofy. You know.
There's a book I want to read that is, I think they are separated, and Banner is on an island, and it's all very, like, Island of Dr. Moreau type thing, where he's, like, making gamma monsters or something like that, and the Hulk has to go in and stop him, and I think that means that he has to reabsorb him in order to kind of stop him, in order to, like, contain him, to contain Banner. So, like, that one, also interesting. And again, kind of fitting in with that structure where it's, like, you are the Hulk. Like, that's who the protagonist is in that book, and you're trying to avoid that, but that's kind of the inevitability.
Yeah, and Immortal Hulk is supposed to be really good, too. We read the first arc, and I don't think it really hooked us. That's one I've been wanting to finish the Krakoa era of X-Men, and then I think Immortal Hulk is the one that I want to go back and try to catch up on afterwards, but, you know, it's so hard.
Yeah. There's so much.
I still haven't like read all of Jason Aaron's Thor run. I've read what we read for the podcast and a little bit more, but that's supposed to be like start to finish, like, holy crap.
I was rereading Ultimate Spider-Man, and I think I got 20 issues in, and I've since been distracted.
Yeah. It's easy to get distracted with long runs.
It is.
Like freaking One Piece, I dropped off. I was binging the anime on Hulu and just got through the end of the Fishman Island arc, and I'm like, okay, I'm taking a break. It'll be a couple of months before I go back to it, I think. There's the anime reference for you, John.
Oh, don't worry, I'm keeping a tally.
Anyway, Hulk Gray. Really great art when it comes to drawing the Hulk in a cave, like, sheltering Betty from the rain, and she's, like, cowering from him in fear. really hated the panels where the Hulk accidentally squishes the head of a bunny.
Oh yeah, that was sad.
That was sad and not in a compelling way. In a make me it just gross and angry way.
That reminds me of a movie, and I don't remember which movie it is. Maybe John knows, but there's a robot
of Mice and Men. Oh, that's robot. Of Mice and Men. Sorry, there's no robots in Of Mice and Men.
No, there's a robot who's petting a cat, and he's petting it too hard, and it's like this horrific scene when they reveal what's happening.
Oh,
that rings a bell, right?
Star Wars?
No.
Oh dear, I have destroyed your kitty.
C-3P, no!
Alright, well, there goes that.
I know what you're talking about, and it's bugging me, and it'll come up later when it's of no help to anyone. Middle of the night me will be, grinding my teeth and thinking of things that I should have said in the seventh grade, and I'll go, oh yeah, it's Bicentennial Man or something, I don't know. I'll come up with it, but...
Well, in the meantime, are we ready to move on to Mockingbird?
Mock, yeah... This He's is been waiting. Although you're supposed to go ing, yeah, and never mind.
Yeah.
Well done. Okay, so Mockingbird, 2016 series, written by Chelsea Kane with a couple of different artists. Series starts with art by Kate Niemczyk, and then the end of the section that we read, the art's by Ibrahim Mustafa, colors by Rochelle Rosenberg. Letters by Joe Caramagna from Virtual Calligraphy. This is a... I don't know if this is the first or the only story about, like, the solo series that Mockingbird has gotten. Mockingbird is Bobby Morse. She's a scientist. She works for S.H.I.E.L.D. She's going in for regular checkups because she's starting to show curious signs of potential superpowers. We see her going back in for her checkups repeatedly over the course of the first issue, but it's obviously skipping through time. Every time we come to this story, she's in the waiting room. There are other recognizable characters in the waiting room with her, and she's always in a different costume. So we can see that she's skipping along through adventures and just coming back for these appointments. And there are all these weird things that keep happening. She has this ability to make these ping pong balls disappear. And she's also seeing these zombies that nobody else seems to be able to see. And it's not clear what is going on or why. This is all very peculiar, though, because Bobby Morse does not really have superpowers. She kind of has Captain America powers. She had the same super soldier serum knockoff that Nick Fury had. So anyway, this whole thing is a bit unusual. So that's issue one. Issues 2, 3, and 4 kind of walk us through the adventures that Mockingbird was having in between her visits to the doctor, including infiltrating the Hellfire Club. She goes underwater to rescue Hawkeye from an AIM knockoff. What was it called?
Tim.
She meets the Queen of England and steals her dog, I think is what happened. She winds up with the Queen of England's dog. She beats up a schoolgirl who is also manifesting crazy superpowers and doesn't mean to, in kind of a horrifying issue 3. And then the whole thing kind of culminates back in the S.H.I.E.L.D. headquarters in a team-up between Mockingbird, Miles Morales, and Howard the Duck trying to escape from the zombie infestation, which is somehow tied in with these superpowers that Bobby is manifesting. She has been infected by a virus that has a mutation that is causing superpowers to manifest in her. And so she ultimately makes the decision not to destroy the virus, but to kind of contain it and then release it. Not in the sense of like infecting the world, but more in the sense of life is interesting and precious, even if it's a virus, and it deserves to be studied, not destroyed. It's kind of a bizarre story, very disjointed, really interesting conceit, an interesting take on a character who I don't think has had a lot of personality outside of being Hawkeye's wife and then Hawkeye's ex-wife. What did y'all think?
I knew nothing about Mockingbird and still don't know what her like exact power set has been, or if it seems here that, like, you know, she's similar to Black Widow or Agent 13, where, you know, super spy is as close as you're going to get. I didn't know she was a scientist, so that was cool. I was, you know, guilty of only knowing her as Hawkeye's ex, which, you know, mm-hmm. played well here. I really enjoyed this, you know, a colorful companion to Hulk Gray, but it is, you know, kind of the house style we've come to expect in the last 10 years or so. But I thought it was funny. I thought there were like a lot of little hidden jokes and stuff, you know, like the intro pages always have different things about, you know, she continues to break her shield beeper that tells her when she needs to come in for a checkup. There's pens that look like they're from a pharmaceutical company, but it's Extremis. You know, Tony Stark is in the waiting room of the shield place reading a pamphlet about gonorrhea. Hercules keeps coming in for different stuff. I don't know. I thought it was funny and tonally, like, interesting. And according to one of the notes at the end of the fourth issue, that, like, you could read them out of order if you wanted to, because there are references throughout to other storylines. Like, there's a Visit Kazakhstan little pin in one of the issues before she actually goes to Kazakhstan to see this mass extinction event that is connected to this virus that's in her. I don't know. I thought it was fun and interesting having a not exactly superpowered person deal with superpowers and how she is developing her own thing while she's also trying to keep up with those superheroes, but also how is she special? How does she stand out? I think.
Yeah, I thought Bobby here was a very interesting character. I think, again, this is kind of from that kind of renaissance. I don't know if that's what I want to call it, but there was like a renaissance right around this time of, you know, giving female characters more agency, more character, and giving them their own stories.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is definitely part of that initiative. That's probably the more appropriate word for it, like that initiative. And I think this is probably one of the better examples. I think I really enjoyed it. I liked Bobby. I liked kind of hearing her deal with a lot of her doubts, her thoughts and opinions about, you know, the situation, the world, her relationships. I don't know. I thought it was good. I really liked the art. I really love the covers by Joelle Jones, who's one of my favorite artists.
Yeah, the covers rule for this whole series.
A little bit of a bummer that those are not the interior art, but the interior art is not bad at all. I really liked it.
Nope.
There were some parts in the interior art where it felt a little bit more posy. Like, it didn't necessarily feel like actual action or movement, but not terrible at all by any mean.
Yeah, it was. It could have been more dynamic. It was well done, well rendered, good and correct, like, anatomically, that kind of thing. The paneling's not bad either. But yeah, a lot of it, you know, does feel like we're going to draw a person in a pose here, as opposed to we're really going to, you know, make them, like, if we're going to pick a moment in this scene to draw for this panel, it's going to be where they're, like, in the most interesting pose possible. It was a little bit more like, you know, I don't know, static? I don't know exactly.
Yeah, I'm actually starting to wonder if that posiness isn't a deliberate stylistic choice. Because I'm thinking of, like, the Allreds, Mike Allred, you know, and his wife, the artist. I forget her name, making me sad. Anyway, like, there is a certain sort of, like, pop art aesthetic to that posiness that makes me wonder, like, it's happening enough among artists who are good at their craft that it's like, maybe they're doing this deliberately and the goal isn't the action, isn't the dynamism, but it is this sort of posiness, this sort of, like, pop aesthetic. Like, maybe that's the point. I don't hate it. Even though it is a little bit stiff, I still like it. It delivers on what I'm going to this comic for.
Yeah, it is still well done.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's not as, you know, unique as I would want if this was like, you know, okay, we're going to do a solo series for the first time and we're, you know, we're doing this character on our own for the very first time. It should have some kind of little flavor. Now, sometimes that doesn't always work. Like, I don't know, I go back and forth on early Ms. Marvel. Is it Fiona Staples who's the artist? Sometimes it gets a little, like, crazy. It's better than her work in the Runaways early on, where it's like, it's almost like things have to be drawn correctly to a point, and then you can start to, you know, mess around with proportions or mess around with other things that kind of maybe go against the rules of art and composition, that kind of thing. And I feel like our early Runaways wasn't quite there. What was good, but what was bad was like, this doesn't look as, you know, professional as you'd want from that's nitpicky. It's all still like, even the worst art on this list is better than I could do. So let's keep that in perspective that I'm not crapping on anybody.
Yeah. Like Red, White, and Blue. No, wait, what was it? No.
Yeah.
Red, White, and Black.
Red. Yeah. Thank you. I knew black was one of the colors. I couldn't remember which one it.
I do not like that at all. It's just a mess.
It's not, but okay.
Man, I'm just looking at these covers, and I deliberately suggested we stop at issue 5 because I remember reading issues 6, 7, and 8. Those are a Civil War II tie-in. I don't remember them being good, but the covers, especially 7 and 8, I love. Issue 8's cover was controversial because it's a picture of Mockingbird standing on the beach drinking something cool and refreshing, and wearing a t-shirt that says, "Ask me about my feminist agenda." I remember there were headlines about that cover in 2016, back when comics news was still kind of a thing.
Yeah, but that also seems like the type of thing that people would get mad about in 2016.
Well, it also seems like the type of thing that somebody would deliberately be a little provocative about.
Yeah.
Very different world in 2016 when, well, okay, this is revealing my privilege a little bit. I was about to say, you know, when fights over displays of feminism were little more than just like good-hearted slap fights. It's like, oh no, Gamergate had happened. Maybe still was happening. Comicsgate was a thing. I didn't actually directly experience any of that, so I'm very much not representing that period well. Regardless, cover rules, the t-shirt rules, I would actually wear that shirt.
I think the people who get offended about that shirt, they're no fun to hang out with at parties. But also, she fights sea monsters, pirate zombies, and Nazi sailor ghosts. So maybe they were also offended by how the Nazis were portrayed as bad guys. People who get offended about that kind of stuff.
Maybe we'll have to go read that story again at some point.
So I did read it. It wasn't
you
great.
Did.
Yeah.
Okay.
I couldn't remember off the top of my head if I was like, oh, did we say 5 issues or did we say the whole thing? So I just read the whole thing. And the latter half was okay. It wasn't bad, but it wasn't by no means what I have called it a great story. A little.
It looks like all that's in Marvel Unlimited from Chelsea Kane is this 8-issue run of Mockingbird, as well as a Civil War II tie-in. That's not part of Mockingbird. Like, it's it's choosing sides. But anyway, I totally really liked it, and how she was thinking about her problems, how she was breaking them down, and it wasn't the same way that superheroes do. And it was, you know, I don't know, it was interesting.
I think the only one of these like sub stories that I had a hard time dealing with was the 3rd issue with the girl who has her friends. And it's not, like, I don't know, like, not that, like, it's uncomfortable of having a sniper trained on a 12-year-old girl. In the context of superheroes, I don't know. I'm not saying that excuses it, but I don't think it's nearly as shocking. However, her whole thing about, you know, we're not prepared to talk to 12-year-old girls, or we can't even talk about other things. There's a lot of messages in there, and I don't think those messages are particularly cohesive. And again, maybe I am just not the right person for this issue, so I don't know how much leg I have to stand on. But this is a female creator-created book, and I am not a female reader.
Yeah, I struggled with that one too, in part because, you know, she kicks the crap out of this kid at one point. I'm like, that's a kid. That's a 12-year-old kid. There also feels like there's a little bit of like, I don't want to say mean-spiritedness necessarily, but I did get the sense that, like, someone's getting made fun of here, and I'm not sure who it is exactly.
Well, like, a kind of small-minded, bigoted news team seems to be getting made fun of, and
well, certainly.
And murdered, so that's not the best, but
certainly, but you've got this girl sitting on the edge of the roof wearing a girl's rock or girl's power t-shirt singing Hamilton. Like, it almost, I don't know. I don't want to read too much into that. I also do not want to read too much into some of the graffiti. Like, the art is just full of little in-jokes. Some of the in-jokes are really funny. Like, Tony Stark is very clearly sitting in the clinic in one of the scenes in issue one, reading a pamphlet about STDs.
Yep.
But in issue three, one of the little jokes is a bit of graffiti that says, Zebediah loves Jessica. And I'm like, nope, that one's not fun.
Is that Purple Man?
That's Purple Man.
Yuck.
Yeah, that's... There are some of those that are really funny. I think on one of the opening pages, I think it would have been issue four or five, it's a letter. I can't remember who the letter's from, but it's to Bobby.
I think it's from, it just says from Chelsea.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So I guess it's the writer. Yeah, yeah. So it's from the writer to Bobby. And it is a letter about, it's about how the structure of this book, which is like nonlinear, is a really good idea and approach. Like, it's just, it just feels like such a weird little pat on the back. Like, I love it. I think it's funny. But I really liked it. I thought that was funny.
My last criticism, I think, because overall I like this book. I don't think the nonlinearity serves the story very well. Because by the time we get back to the clinic in issue five, I've lost the thread a little bit.
Yeah. It's... I appreciate it. I like what they were going for. This feels, this in earnest, and I don't mean this in a derogatory way. I hope it doesn't come out like that. Is this feels very inspired by like Pulp Fiction, which I know is such a dude bro cinema guy take on this.
It's a lady dude bro in this case.
Yeah. But I liked it, but I will not argue that it was hard to follow. I actually just found like a reading guide that tells you when each issue takes place in relativity to issue one. Like, issue two takes place between pages 2 and 3. Issue three takes place between 10 and 11. And issue four takes place between 15 and 16. Which, if I remember correctly, because I didn't pay attention to the page numbers, because I'm paying attention to the art, those are the pages where she is visiting the doctor for her various checkups.
Always an interruption to what she's got going on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think I really like when they, you know, play around with nonlinear narrative in something I'm watching or reading or whatever. And when done right, it can really just, add a whole lot to it. Project Hail Mary, kind of like that. It's more just flashbacks. It's like he does get his flashbacks in an order, but like the last flashback is what happened immediately before the beginning of the book. And so it's like two timelines kind of running, you know, concurrently. It's less nonlinear as opposed to like really good flashbacks. I don't know. I really like that book, so I'm not doing it justice, but this could have, I don't know, there could have been more reminders of the ongoing problems with these zombies, with this virus. Like, there could have been, you know, a few more hints dropped throughout leading up to the last issue. But overall, yeah, I really liked it. And anytime, you know, it gets zany, like, okay, Miles Morales has to get his costume on and get out of his weird hospital gown where he's still wearing his mask and team up with Howard the Duck, who's really going through some stuff, and fight zombies. Like, that's just one. That's just, you know,
yeah. There's, I think for me, is the problem is I don't feel like there was a super strong connecting thread throughout the nonlinearity. Mm-hmm. And I think that actually, I think the zombies were meant to be part of that, right? Because in that first issue, we see the progression of seeing more of the zombies. We see her kind of dealing with the zombies. We see her powers kind of better, get stronger. And we see some of that in the other issues, right? When she's in the submarine with Clint, she uses her powers to help get them out of it, I think, or something mm-hmm. like that. Like, she locks herself up to kind of cause a fight or flight response in her body.
Trying to test it out. And
yeah, to shut down the flooding sequence. So there's a few things like that, but I felt like there wasn't like a very, like a super strong enough thread where in the following issues, I could be like, oh, okay, this is what was happening then, or this is what was happening then. And the fact that issue five just picks up where issue one left off doesn't really give me like a very strong connection of like, oh, this is what everything was building up to. Because the other issues, because 2, 3, and 4 were very much like their own separate stories, but kind of not really. Or maybe I'm just too dense. Also a possibility.
No, I had the same problem.
I liked when Hawkeye showed up, and I liked that she saved some corgis. So I think we should take the best parts of this story, the dog and Hawkeye, and fix the nonlinear narrative and do a better job of it. Maybe employing really clean art and good color work to kind of show the jumps between time. And I don't know. Do you guys think there's something there? Do you think that's something that they should be doing, that there's enough there?
I do think there's enough there. I don't quite 100% get it, but I also don't know that it needs it, because like issues 1, 2, and 4 are so much fun. And heck, 5 as well. 3, I struggled with 3. But issue 5, even though it isn't quite carrying the momentum from the previous issues, it still has Miles getting sheepish, putting on his pants in front of Mockingbird because he's in the clinic and he's, you know, wearing a gown. It still has Howard the Duck using his duck foo or whatever it's called. It's still fun. It's a fun read overall. And even though it's not like the complaints that I have about the narrative inconsistency, the lack of a really solid through line, those are just complaints that are going to keep it out of like the best of the best. It's still very solidly landing in the good section of the list for me.
Yeah.
I was just making a reference to Matt Fraction being snarky there, but never mind.
Gotcha.
Oh, well, I apologize for taking you earnestly and seriously.
I don't.
You should know better.
But yeah, I will say, I liked the book. I enjoyed it. I think that was a very strong effort. Like, a nonlinear narrative is very hard to pull off. The people that can pull it off, you know, props to them. Christopher Nolan, arguably.
Yeah.
Pulp Fiction, the writer from it.
Grant Morrison.
No.
Who apparently loves the Konosuba movie, so another anime reference for you.
Don't worry, John. That one lost me, too.
Yeah, don't worry, guys.
I was like, you mean Quentin Tarantino? I mean, he writes and directs. What do you mean, the writer?
The screenwriter.
Oh, I thought he did that one. Anyway.
Yeah, no, apparently not. But yeah, so it is a very good effort. I don't think overall it was bad. Like, there weren't any huge inconsistencies. Once I kind of picked up on the non-linearity of it, I was like, okay, good. I just had a hard time relating events to issue 1, which is, I feel, the crux of this whole project, essentially, right? Like, that's the one that is jumping in time, and the other ones are filling in the blanks. I just was not super good at relating those. I think for me, the moment where I was like, oh, okay, like there was a little bit of a payoff for me, was when I started to pick up that the costume she was wearing in, like, by the end of the story, was the costume she was in issue 1 at that doctor's visit. Specifically when, after she rescues, was it Hunter from the
London Hellfire Club?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because in issue 1, she's like, I can explain the outfit. And then we get to that issue and I was like, oh, hey, yeah, there it is. There's that explanation.
does the silence mean it's time to rank?
Yeah, I'm interested to see where this will end up, because it's very good, but how good is it?
Yeah, good question. And how is the other one? So currently on our list, we have 279 stories. Guys, we've read a lot of comics. If I recall, there it is. Daredevil Yellow is pretty high on our list. It's currently at number 36. And that's our kind of high-ranking comparable. Going down towards the bottom of the list, I mean, Hulk is actually one of the worst stories we've read. Was a Hulk story. Ultimate Wolverine versus Hulk is number 272 currently out of 279. That was just a wretched book. But yeah, our list has more.
I would argue he's only 50% responsible for the horribleness in that book.
Yeah.
True. Wolverine also has his own share of nastiness.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, the list has more good than bad on it. Where do we want to rank Hulk Gray? I swear we've read Spider-Man Blue, but I don't think we actually have.
No, I think I've just read it often enough in my personal time that it's like, oh, I know where it goes. I was looking for Wolverine and Gambit, which is another Jeff Loeb, Tim Sale one that we read. Not a color themed one, but we read that.
That's at number 103.
103. I think that should be a floor, because I don't know.
I would argue that it's a ceiling.
Oh, well, gloves are off then.
I don't know. I found the story of Hulk Gray to be kind of unpleasant, but the art good. So
art good, does good story,
art mediocre. Good story mediocre. Our one word sentences are veering away from Hulk and towards Immortan Joe.
Sorry.
You're good. So like I don't know that comics are a visual medium, and yet if the story isn't enjoyable or pleasant or engaging, I'm not likely to pick up a book solely for the art if I find the story too off-putting. And in this case, I kind of do. I just, when I think about this book, I think of that image of the Hulk squishing a rabbit. Mm-hmm. And I get it. It's a literary reference. It's of Mice and Men. It's whatever the robot movie was. Doesn't mean that I want it in my Biff Bam Pow superhero comic. And I know that's reductive too. I don't care.
I thought it was a reference to like a tie-in to Trix and like a Trix commercial or something. Okay.
Oh, yucks.
I thought it was a criticism on the animation industry and Warner Brothers.
Make mine Marvel. All right. I'm trying to think. I'm looking at some of these and I'm like, well, I mean, I don't dislike this one, but do I like this one better than, what, I don't know, where are you at?
I mean, I'm there. I don't think I go significantly lower than that. I don't think. Because, like, the art is good. Like, okay, does this go below the line where the stories actually start to get kind of, I don't know. Like, I think that portion of the list is, you know, beneath the Star Wars New Hope manga. I don't know that it really goes that low, because that art is really good.
Yeah.
But... like, I'm probably... yeah, I'm okay. I'm actually kind of struggling with this one.
Aldo,
bail us out.
Oh, I'm the worst person to bail you out right now. I don't have strong opinions on this book. I legitimately do not.
You have a podcast. That's part of the job description.
I have stronger opinions about Mockingbird than this, but... oh.
So, I don't know. I think, what, our floor is now 130, but our ceiling is... where is it? It disappeared. Yeah.
103.
103. Okay. Fair.
Would you rather read this than The Children's Crusade?
Yes.
Where's The Children's Crusade?
114.
114. I mean, this is shorter.
I would put it above Worst X-Men Ever at the make it the new 111.
You know, I would argue a little one higher than that, because Secret Invasion, for as much as I like it in memory, actually reading it was a little disappointing.
That's fair. I think I'm just thinking about the one Deadpool tie-in that I read that had cool art and it was funny, and he tricks them all into duplicating copies of themselves in Deadpool's image, but he gives all the Skrulls cancer, so he outsmarts him and annoys Nick Fury the whole time.
I will say that, like, telling people about Secret Invasion is much more interesting than reading Secret Invasion.
Mm.
Yeah, that's actually true of a lot of comics, unfortunately. I don't know, telling people about the cool comic stories I read was the only way that I made friends in high school.
Really? That's how you made friends? That never worked for me.
At least once. I did not have many friends. yeah, the more I think about it, the more I think it should go lower, but I'm also, like... not really interested in fighting for it to go lower. This list is a weird democratic project, so I'm
yeah.
Yeah, I would put it at 110, throw something out there.
Hey, if it's not getting over Mary Jane and Black Cat, we're fine.
No, that's my I ceiling.
Yeah. I did see that and I was like, well, we're not going to break that barrier.
So. Oh, no. Nobody in here proclaims to have a dump truck. Would it have improved the book? Maybe. If Thaddeus Thunderbolt Ross was like, find that monster who has a dump truck.
I should be the only one with a dump truck. I have back.
Call me baby, because I got back. But father, you can't throw it back. I'll throw whatever I want, Betty. I told your mother this, I'll tell you this. I throw it back.
I am the one who drops it like it's hot. My milkshake. Now we're crossing over into There Will Be Blood. My milkshake brings all the boys to the yard. I drink your milkshake and then I bring all the boys to the yard.
All right, so 110?
Yeah. Let's get out of here.
All right.
Yeah, okay. So where does Mockingbird go then?
Not in Eminem's hands. I'll tell you that much right now.
Oh, gosh. I forgot he did that.
Aldo, are you editing? You want to put in a cricket noise or just...
I don't have one available, but I probably will.
I was just completely lost there.
He has a song called Mockingbird. At the end of the song, he says that Mockingbird doesn't sing, Daddy's going to snap its neck and send it back.
I picked that up from context clues, but I am white. Like
so is Eminem.
So is Eminem.
Yeah, I know. But he raps, and when I think about what if John rapped, it's like, oh no.
So anyway, let's set aside that uncomfortable moment and talk about.
No, I'm looking because it goes in the solid stories, not like the best of the best, but like, hey, this is what a comic should be.
Okay, I think I found my ceiling.
Okay.
I'm not saying it goes right here, but I think the ceiling is Civil War II Kingpin.
Where's that at?
That's at number 89.
Oh, that's not that much higher. Okay.
It's not that much higher, which is part of the reason I think Hulk Gray should go a little bit lower. But again, weird Democratic project, and the votes have it. I think, oh geez, I actually might have been able to narrow it down a lot, because I think I like this better than the Peter Porker Spider-Ham story, which is at 96 currently.
Wow, we put that kind of high.
Yeah, that one was ridiculous. How did it end up? Maybe because it was just, it's Spider-Man. That's why it's high.
Oh, because it did a lot of work at making Spider-Ham likable towards the end of the book. Like, there was a lot of significant character growth, actually, now that I remember about it.
Yeah. That's my vote, is somewhere in that range, or at least that's what I'm putting up.
You know, even with the lack of a dump truck statement in here, I would have to agree.
Yeah, I think it could go right after. It could go at number 90.
Yeah. On the comics dialogue scale of Dump Truck and Scuttlebutt, where does this land?
Surprisingly, only one of those is about the posterior.
Gosh. My buddy used to have a metric for movies, like, okay, like is this a good X-Men movie? Is it a bad X-Men movie? Good, bad, whatever. He also had to include features or does not feature Cyclops. And it was like, is James Marsden in this movie? Is there a Cyclops character in this movie? How does it measure up, you know?
I mean, there's worse criteria to work off of.
Yeah, I vote the new 90.
Yeah, I actually don't hate that placement. It's funny, yeah. Deadly Genesis is like a historic story. It's not a great story.
And I like Len Wein too, and so...
Yeah, it's fine. Mockingbird goes above it. The trade story is called I Can Explain, which I think is great.
Yeah.
So yeah, cool.
Yeah.
Good ranking. Curious, are we settled on our story for next time?
Yeah.
I have no arguments against it.
Okay, we're going to read The Sins of Sinister, which is a Krakoa-era event. It's not the first of the Krakoa-era events, so I anticipate being a little bit lost with the status quo, because I get the sense that things moved very quickly in the Krakoa era, and I still have only read about the first year of those stories. But I've been wanting to read Sins of Sinister ever since I started seeing it reviewed in some of the little bits of comics media I still read, and I'm excited to get to it. It's an event comic. It's a pretty lengthy one. The reading list in Marvel Unlimited has, I think, 13 issues in total, which is about as much as I ever like to read for one of these episodes. So we'll just have the one story, and hopefully it gives us enough to chew on that we can, you know, fill up a full episode.
Is this our first Sinister story?
Is it our first Sinister story?
I know he's shown up, but I don't think he was like a major character.
I don't think he's been the main character. He featured very prominently in the start of the Krakoa era, but wasn't a main character. I'm sure he's in one of those ridiculous 90s crossovers that we read. Maybe Executioner's Song. But again, not the main protagonist or antagonist.
I don't think he's in that well. He's involved, I think, in some of that stuff, but he's not. I don't remember him being in Executioner's Song. He's in Age of Apocalypse, but that one is just too much for us. We haven't read it yet. It's a lot.
Bucket list is figuring out how to do Age of Apocalypse in this format, because that is such a nostalgia bomb for me. We have to read it at some point.
My bucket list is getting us to read all of Ultimate Spider-Man.
I thought your bucket list was getting us to read Trouble.
No.
Oh, that one. Okay, that one is a bucket list, but that one is much more achievable. And I'm going to make sure that that happens for our 300th story. I have bought 1/3 of the books.
Did you?
You bought that?
Oh, yeah.
That puts you on a list, I'm pretty sure.
I'm following through. I am buying hardcover copies for everybody.
Hear about John? 300 or 299 episodes, and he just up and quit. He was grossed out? What did he say?
Weird. I bought it. It still had the plastic wrap. It's still like a first print hardcover. Like, they did not print any more of those. They're in a warehouse somewhere, hidden in the Nevada desert, I'm sure. But I'm going to make sure we read that at some point on this podcast.
Holy cow, there's a Predator versus Wolverine comic in Marvel Unlimited.
Well, I know what we're reading after Sinister.
Yeah.
Seriously.
I just wish, we could get the Justice League versus Avengers books in here. That'd be so great.
I was actually at a comic book store today and almost got an old comic that I got. Remember the DC versus Marvel comics?
Yeah.
There was a follow-up series where one of the characters in there, Axis was his name, and they kept it going where, like, uh-oh, Venom's in Metropolis. I got to go bring Spider-Man over so that Superman can fight Venom, but, like, you know, get the upper hand on him with Spider-Man's help, and I'm the go-between dude or whatever. And I was about to get this issue, and then I kept flipping through the long box, and it was like, most of it was this issue. And I was like, ah, this didn't, I was the only one who actually gave a crap about that. Okay, never mind.
You're like, this explains a lot.
Yep.